This is a lecture by L. Ron Hubbard, given on the 28th of October, 1955. The title of this lecture is Intolerance. This lecture is 61 minutes long. Reproduced by Golden Era Productions.
All right, this second morning lecture of October 28, 1955, 4th London ACC. I've been very frank now on the subject of the evolution of processes and the actuality of these processes in action and what monitors them in their operation. I'd better tell you now about the remaining processes and the underlying principles of them. The first level we have covered to a very definite degree, the commands as given and as they are workable are discoverable on written material. We needn't go into that. But the second level of process is to some slight degree displaced. It is there to point up the fact that an individual must be in darn good two-way communication before you run level three, which is subjective processes. That's why it's there. Now, at this level, I could say offhand that we should take up this and we should take up that and so forth, but this would not be true. I would just be dressing up the picture to make it look good. The fact of the matter is the PC's got to be in a point of origin. Very good, and in a point of acknowledgement, very good, and not because he's been educated to be, but just because he is. All right, therefore, we take this second level, and we find out at once that there is a lower harmonic on the second level, and that the second level probably should lie below the first level, too. We start the session, of course, with communication, but it's not two-way communication. Usually it's kind of one way and bogged up and so forth, so it'd be a misnomer to call it that way, but the auditor's talking, and the preclear's answering, and the preclear's originating, or the preclear's talking compulsively, and the auditor's trying to get in some of his material one way or the other. And we couldn't run, of course, the present time problem or start the rudiments of the session at all unless we paid some attention to two-way communication. Right? So, let us go into the theory of two-way communication and discover at once the two-way communication as is. It as is. It knocks out of existence, it unmocks various somatics and materials and is therefore intensely useful. And there are many methods of using two-way communication. The first way is simply to let somebody talk about something and confide in you. This is about the oldest, creakiest, down at the heels, misunderstood psychotherapy that man has had. Somebody could come in and confess. What's the difference between confess and pay? Just the coin is more solid when you pay. So anybody who is terribly interested in having somebody confess is actually merely dramatizing the lower echelon of having to make somebody pay, do you understand? The police are underpaid, therefore they have to make people confess. Probably confession has nothing whatsoever to do with crime detection. In this modern age, a lie detector can much more efficiently determine the facts of the case. For failure to use the lie detector victimizes every decent citizen in the world. I mean, it's as simple as this. Failure to understand completely the activities of lie detectors has thrown them a little bit into disuse. A lie detector works because of ownership processing. That's all. You get the fellow to make some statements or think about something, and if he's misowning on the subject, you get a read on the lie detector. That's the totality of lie detectors and e-meters. Anything that is misowned is then capable of registering an electrical charge. Follow me? Anything which is misowned is capable of an electric charge. confessed guilt or admission when the action has not been taken will register equally with stated innocence when guilt is present. You follow me? A failure to understand the principles of ownership has put the entire lie detector industry into a little bit of a question. It's quite an industry. There are tremendous numbers of these things built. They use the most fantastic apparatus to establish these simple facts. The blood pressure and respiration and all kinds of things are measured on these very intricate machines. Lie detector, by the way, is much more efficient than the electroencephalograph. An electroencephalograph, which is used in some diagnostic work, by the way, is just diverging there for a moment. Electroencephalograph is so unreliable and so stupid a mechanism that the fellow who invented it and the companies that are selling it could be sued for fraud. I mean, it's really for the birds. I know, I'm an electronics man, I speak with authority. An engineer looks at this and looks at these graphs and finds out that you could interpret anything off of these graphs. Nobody has ever been able to convince me that these graphs were interpretable. Because they have taken somebody they knew had a brain tumor because of X-ray, and then they've gotten a pattern. And then they haven't gone out and found 15 or 20 guys and run them all through the machine to see if whether or not they got the same pattern. I have. They do. They don't have brain tumors, and they get brain tumor patterns. In other words, this is not a good mechanism. It would appear to be a good mechanism to somebody who did not know electronics, but an electroencephalograph is so poor that it has to be totally shielded, and you have to put the patient in a wire cage 100% before you could depend upon its graphs. Any radio wave, any static, any light switch turning on and off anywhere in the vicinity of an electroencephalograph will disturb the graph which is making. I talked to an engineer about this one time from Westinghouse, and he and I had quite a confabulation about this, and he was being very, very learned. He was an expert on this. He was being very, very learned until all of a sudden he said, Hubbard, are you so-and-so? Oh, so-and-so, you're so-and-so's friend. Oh, yeah, you're an engineer. And he just changed his tune. Grr, whoomph. Well, he could go and tell all the lies he wanted to customers. But in this particular wise, it was not wise. Now, the behavior of electrical energy is a specialized subject when you're conduiting it through wires and so forth. Anybody knows something about energy, you know. Anybody present knows practically all there is to know about energy if you ran him so that he would know. But it's a specialized subject, see? And as a specialized subject, then you must take into account all of the various factors in the specialized subject which could influence the graph, see? The mind is a specialized subject. Scientologists know about it. They have to take into account all of the various items which could influence a graph of any kind in order for the graph be useful, see? So a lie detector has relatively small usefulness to somebody who doesn't know very much about the behavior of the mind. A police detective running a lie detector who knows nothing about the mind, he's not a Dianeticist, Scientologist, is sufficiently unreliable that no jury in the world to date will take the evidence of a lie detector. Yet, the use of a lie detector, used with intelligence, could actually save the average citizen from endless suspicion, interrogation, and could clear up at once the subject of guilt. All the court is there to do is establish the subject of guilt or innocence on the crimes before it. It is there to uphold the mores of the society. And therefore, it is in order to uphold these and to act with justice, it must act within the realm of truth. And as long as the court itself cannot, by its rules of evidence, establish accurately the justice or injustice of a case, it therefore cannot itself act with justice, and there will be no justice. Now let's look at this thing, this electroencephalograph. Practically nobody uses one of these things, by the way. It is relatively unused. because an X-ray will tell a brain tumor and so forth. The people who use this at all themselves are upset by the machine. You would have to be a fine electronics man in order to use one. You should have had a couple of years of electronics and engineering before you began to work with the machine, because the tiniest little thing could upset the reading. You follow me? So that anything that requires that much specialized education must itself be suspect. And let us ask ourselves at once what it is measuring. Very pertinent to auditing. What is it measuring? It is measuring the ebb and flow and change of electrical energies of various potentials which are present in or absent from the human anatomical structure. And that's what an electroencephalograph is measuring. And that's what a lie detector is measuring. It's not measuring the sweat on the palm. I have talked to a phrenologist, I think that's what they call him, endlessly on this subject, trying to demonstrate to him that there was such a thing as an electronic standing wave or ridge in connection with a human being. See? And this escapes his understanding. He can feel the sweat on somebody's palm. He can count beneath a microscope somebody's pores. Why? He has been trained to look at palms and sweat as a nervous symptom, and he has been equally well trained in the idea that an individual has nervous reactions, which are quivers of one kind or another. And so he is trying to explain the electrical phenomena of the lie detector through the interpretation of a physiological thing, since he is a physiologist, a psychologist is a physiologist, basically. That's something that you must never overlook in talking to them. The whole structure of psychology, by the way, came to being when Wundt joined physiology with studies of the mind. That's something you mustn't overlook. It's a physiological study. It's not a study of the mind, and today is getting honest enough to admit that it's not a study of the mind, since its latest definitions are that it does not study the mind, nor even it does not study the soul or even the mind anymore, in spite of the fact that it's called psychology. See? All right. This man would have to be, again, an electronics man, but he'd have to be more than an electronics man to understand this lie detector. He would have to be, to understand it 100%, he would have to be, one, an electronics man, and two, a Scientologist. And then he could understand exactly what it was saying, and oddly enough, interpret it perfectly. It would take a Scientologist, then, to read these things. Now, you should understand that 17% or something like that of the readings on a lie detector are thought to be erroneous by a police detective using one. You see this? 17% are supposed to be erroneous. 9 or 10% of the cases he gets do not register at all on this. Why? They are the same cases that do not register on your e-meter. They get a stuck needle. The person is so stuck in some sort of a standing ridge that no matter how many questions you ask him, you get no disturbance of the electrical condition of his body. Now, that's important to you as an auditor. We have objective phenomena here. We have meters that measure this fact, that there's about 9% of the people who are walking on the streets right now who would not disturb a lie detector one single bit, because nothing they think influences anything physiological about them, and nothing they hear influences any physiological thing about them. They are unable to make a postulate stick to such a degree that there is no influence between the mind and the body. The body is totally on stimulus response. It is running without any monitoring. These people do then comprise the bulk of the criminal population. So we get this fascinating thing. The lie detector used in the field of crime is unable to work on the greatest criminals. We expect educationally conscience to be a check on these people. Conscience can only be a check on somebody if it re-stimulates the somatic. If these people can act without any pattern of re-stimulation whatsoever, they can then act to do anything. And do, because they act without direction, without moral guidance. And one of them, and I have investigated these people, by the way, with great fascination, you know. I'm not afraid to get my hands dirty in life. I never really have the idea that you can get your hands dirty in life. And I've gone down into the smelliest jails you ever want to see and talk to criminals and so forth. And it would just fascinate you. They will argue on the very central points on which they will be condemned. Now, the law says that sanity is the ability to tell right from wrong, but they don't say what crime is beyond it's something against the law. An individual will only commit a crime when he cannot differentiate between right and wrong. I mean, that's the long and short of this. If he could really tell right from wrong, he wouldn't commit a crime on the various dynamics. He wouldn't act violently against one or another of these dynamics if he could tell right from wrong. He would act more or less instinctively right, you see. Now, when we depress him to a point of where his mind cannot influence his energy banks, he is then unable to influence his own motions and actions, and he becomes a thing of the moment. Somebody says rob, he robs. Somebody says spit, he spits. Somebody says spin, he spins. The romantic criminal, the Robin Hood of the public eye, who's very, very often deified by the William Randolph Hearst because they give him more space than anybody else, is not even a wound-up doll. The real criminal is so nuts that he doesn't even have enough direction to be nutty. This is fascinating. And lie detectors do not work on the real criminal. If a lie detector or an e-meter were sitting there non-functional on somebody, we consider then he is either stuck completely in a standing ridge or that nothing he thinks can influence any energy pattern of his body. In other words, no postulates stick, no postulates unfix. He is therefore a stimulus-response mechanism. What do you know? These are both the same thing. If a person's postulates will or will not stick, a person can or cannot influence any ridge in which he's interiorized. So we have this thing. This is fantastic. We have then a test, which is one of the most interesting tests, and which would clear out of the way at once. The people who were put on lie detectors and let loose because there was no registry of guilt or innocence are people who probably ought to be in the clink anyhow. See? So therefore, the lie detector fails. Now, why am I talking to you about lie detectors? Because it is an electronic mechanism by which the actions of an individual can, by and large, be determined. It works on the electronic structure of the body. The electronic structure is disturbed whenever ownership is miscalled. We get more ridge whenever we miscall the ownership of the ridge. We get an electronic manifestation of the act when we get a misownership of the act. And that is why a lie detector works. Now that is the basic background facts of a lie detector. And where it does not act at all, we can assume, no matter how rationally sometimes sounds, that the individual is unable to influence electrical energy in any way by thinking. Now, that would be fantastic. How can a guy be that bad off, you know? You know, he thinks and nothing happens. There's no interaction between mind and body at all. Why? Because the mind does not have sufficient force or power to cause an interaction to take place. He has lost to motionlessness. He has lost to motion. He has lost to not knowingness and annoyingness to such a degree that he simply backed off almost entirely. And you're looking at a wound-up GE, which is acting on a stimulus-response basis. Now, do you know that a person in a deep trance can be banged out of his head regardless of what kind of condition he's in? Did you know that? If you got a person in a deep enough trance, you would simply say, you will now appear in Afghanistan. And lying there in a deep trance, you report back to me the hot dope. Or you will now jump over and pick up a body in India. Well, a funny thing will occur. He will become to some degree detached from the ridges in which he has been fixed on your determinism. And he sort of gets charged up on your determinism and carries forward on that basis. Do you know how that's how they make the between lives switches, the body switches? The old space opera whole track mechanism was to knock somebody flat and keep him in incarceration for a long time, having sent him away to inhabit somebody and influence him politically. You aware of that? This is one of the old wheezes of the line. Therefore, there are people that you would walk into that you would say, be 3 feet back of your head, and they would at once. At once. And you would say, be 10 feet above the roof, and he would be at once. But he probably wouldn't be able to tell you about it. Got it? His basic recognition would be so determined by your determinism and so on that you would merely have to assume these things were taking place. We got it? So you can go down to a sanitarium occasionally and bang people out of their heads with no gain of case. You could also bang them into somebody else's body if you wanted to. To these people, no force or postulate can hold, no opinion can hold contrary to yours. They're unable to establish their own whereabouts on their own determinism. And that is the bottom of the ledger, and that is a criminal. Now, not all people who do that are criminals, but people who are in that condition can simply come up against a bad influence and become criminal. Why? The stimulus response, you see. The study of stimulus response would result in the study of the lowest order of Homo sapiens. If you only studied stimulus response, you would find yourself continually scraping elbows with the lowest order of cat. You see that? Well, why would you do that? It's because stimulus response would only work 100% on people who themselves could not confront or combat stimulus response. See, a stimuli appears in the environment, a response occurs in the body. And when you've got this neatly going, there mustn't be, there probably isn't, any intervention. But where you have an individual who is just barely able to monitor the stimulus response a little bit, you see, he's able to monitor it a little bit, we get a manifestation which Freud mistook for censor, what he called the censor. That was a thetan in lousy condition, who could sometimes interrupt the stimulus response mechanism. But we were still studying, basically, stimulus response, you see? Now, we had to study a very low order of being in order to study these two things. What is the common denominator between these two things? Actually, the fellow who can barely, now and then, interrupt one of his impulses or actions, and the fellow who cannot interrupt any of his impulses or actions, but just acts. These two together are suffering from, one, intolerance of motion, two, intolerance of no motion, that's stationariness, three, intolerance of stupidity, and four, of course, intolerance of all phenomena, to such a degree that they've simply given up. If you could conceive apathy to be a total intolerance, you have the picture. Intolerance, you believe, perhaps, is something that is expressed. A fellow says, I don't like that, so you think you're looking at intolerance. No, I'm afraid that's not true. The total intolerance is apathy. If you're totally intolerant, you would take no action of any kind. Now, somehow or other, we've got to take this preacher and we've got to fish him up the scale. If he isn't reacting rapidly on level one, we must conceive at once that our preclear is intolerant on all of these points. He is not expressing himself, but he is intolerant. See? Now, without lie detector, without encephalograph, without mechanical means of any kind, the auditor can establish characteristics of this nature. And this is very important. The phenomenon is there to be observed. I am not now talking about a handful of air. I am not now talking about a theory that has its authority from having been published in 1825. See, I'm not. I'm talking about materials which you yourself, if you wanted to go out into the society, could look over very carefully and find that they were holding true all the way along the line. You would find out, if you wished to do so, that on the finest lie detector or the worst home-built E-meter, that you would get the mechanisms of ownership as the fundamental behind the behavior of the instrument. He owns the act that he didn't do. You get a reaction on the meter. He says he didn't do the act that he did do, and you get a reaction on the meter. In other words, he misowns the act he owns. He really owns, and you get a meter reaction. He misowns the act somebody else did, and you get a reaction on the E-meter, or the lie detector, either one. You also get respiratory reactions, and you also get blood pressure reactions. And this is true except in those cases which cannot influence energy or anything. And that's not true, then, that you would get any action because of misownership on the E-meter. But the only thing that you would get there, you'd get no action on anything on an E-meter. So, similarly, you very often have a preclear sitting in front of you who gets no reaction on anything. Well, they're a very funny thing, you know. You've told him to think this and think that, and he got a little tiny somatic, finally, after you worked for about 18 hours. What's the matter with this guy? Well, you better know here and now what's the matter with him. He might be talking to you one way or the other, sort of at random. But two-way communication is a better E-meter than an E-meter. There's something wrong with his origin, his acknowledgement, his receipt of your acknowledgement, or the receipt of your communication. There is something non-sequitur about the answers he gives you. There are long time spaces. There are compulsive outflows. There are all kinds of bugs in the straight two-way communication formula which you find in the book, Dianetics 1955. There are bugs in this. Well, there are bugs in the whole communication formula, and those bugs consist of no recognition of the fact that energy sources exist, no recognition of any other terminal, and maybe not himself either. See, there are bugs in the whole thing. There's also the bug of no interest. There's also the bug of no duplication. There's also the bug of no attention or fixated attention, unable to handle or shift attention. And all these things add up to is the fact that you ran him for 18 hours and he was not getting any better in any way, shape, or form. You see? And he told you that he was getting no action or reaction. You know what you assume? You haven't got an E-meter now. You're just sitting talking to this boy, and there's something offbeat about him. But the main thing you notice offbeat about him, that no matter what he runs, he does not get a reaction in his bank, in his body, in his environment. You know what you assume at that point? Something very simple. You assume that he is so intolerant of everything and anything, and especially stupidity, motion, and not motion, that he himself is incapable, in the state he is in, of influencing electrical energy, space, or his body in any way, shape, or form. Now, that man is a criminal or not a criminal, is sane or insane with this accident. It's just an accident that he isn't. The stimulus response mechanism of his training has not been in the pattern of sanity or insanity, criminality or incriminality, but he's not one of those, you see? It's just missing from the stimulus response pattern. My Lord, will you please look at what an accident this society depends on for the good behavior of an enormous percentage of its citizens. Isn't that fantastic? Did he have a criminal around him? Well, he fortunately didn't have a criminal around him, so he went through school all right, and he got there somehow. The society that operates on the basis of building in gimmicks into individuals so that they'll then run on them will eventually fail. It'll eventually come into crime. It'll eventually come into criminal politics. It will do all sorts of wild and incredible things because the society and mom and papa, the best interest in the society, the highest and most moral parts of the society, and mama and papa are not the person's total influence. If we could raise this person in a hothouse, if we could make sure that he never came in contact with anybody but a good mom and a good papa and a good moral level in education and the government, we could then be sure that our boy would come out of it scot-free, doing well, bungling along, operating as a camouflaged hole in some factory. One day the machines start breaking down and we find out we have nothing but camouflaged holes in the whole flam-dam factory. The whole factory closes down. What an accident. We assume with a stimulus response mechanism that a great many people in the society simply will not accidentally come in the influence of a criminal or an insane person. We just assume this, so we won't have any stimulus response mechanisms in the bank accordingly. Now, a person who can run an engram is a person who can influence energy. A person who cannot run an engram is a person who cannot influence energy. A person who is immediately swamped by an engram is a person who is totally swamped by the energy manifestation. His intolerance has gotten to such a point that he himself is powerless in the face of the threat. Maybe we use the word tolerance inadvisedly, and yet we can detect visibly the decay of tolerance in the individual up to a certain point, but we must remember that it's tolerance from there on down that is suffering. He's getting more and more intolerant until he just quits. When you look at this game called life that way, that a person becomes more and more intolerant of life, first he wants to play it, he guesses, and then he becomes intolerant and critical, and then he becomes more and more critical, and then he becomes more and more critical, and then he becomes more and more critical, and as he becomes more and more critical, he starts to quit on more and more fronts. He starts to influence less and less, and finally he influences nothing, which is total intolerance of the whole works. He wants to quit the game, but he's still there. He leaves this body running on a stimulus response mechanism. An engram comes up, the training pattern goes into gear, and he, like a little wound-up doll, goes in that direction. I would hate to live in a society which depended absolutely and utterly upon a stimulus response characteristic to carry it forward, because someday the bottom's going to fall out. See? So therefore, your study is stimulus response mechanism only to this degree. Only to this degree. To the degree that it establishes for you the intolerance or tolerance of the individual. Somebody's totally stimulus response, voila. He's completely intolerant. Therefore, he's a complete mechanism. He would be incapable of differentiation between right and wrong, and you could run him and 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 run him without his influencing energy at all, unless you raised his tolerances. See that? So this is the first thing we face. We have to show the individual there is something he can do to something by thinking. And we say this reality on Scientology, we mean this, not a reality of data, not a reality of workability. But because we were sitting there and talking to him, he discovered, strangely and peculiarly enough, that he, by thinking about something, could influence it. And there is the case entrance. And there's the first entrance point of a case. Regardless of how many rules we lay down, there is the entrance point of a case, right there. We have brought the individual to realize that by thinking about something, he could influence it. That thought could monitor structure. Now, I'll give you this. You are dealing with a society which has been educated quite in the reverse. Not reverse the structure monitors function, but that the body just kind of keeps on running somehow, and there's nothing you can do with thought about any part of it. And you will find even young people who should be able to work very well under auditing going through this manifestation. They will think, well, they can't do anything by thinking about it. This has been made part of their stimulus response pattern. A more vicious thing could never happen to a youth of any land than to teach them that they could not influence anything by thinking about it. You see this? Therefore, we are fortunate indeed in a preclear who has an early presentation of a present time problem to the auditor and who then solves it by the auditor's direction. We're just lucky. He had a little problem, we solved it. And he will sit there and he will say, well, well, well. If we ask this fellow one way or the other by doing what we say, if we coax him into influencing one way or another, some aspect of his body or his beingness, and he says, well, 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 by thinking about something, I could influence it. See this? Well, now, most of the preclears you get have not dropped to a total intolerance. They're still playing the game. They're not leaving a wound-up doll there to play the game for them. They're still playing the game to some degree. As a matter of fact, 90% of them are still playing the game to some degree. But the odd part of it is some of the remaining 9 or 10% will do this great oddity. They will get an engram into restimulation which tells them that they need auditing. And you, you chump, beat your brains in on an engram. And the case hangs up, and it won't move, and it won't do anything. And the preclear one day skids a little bit or eats some yeast or something, and it moves the engram on the track a little bit, and they start to cry, or they start to scream, or they start to get sad, and they tell you, look what you did to me as an auditor. Look what Scientology has done to me. Look how horrible it all is. Just as they say to a medical doctor who was foolish enough to be in his office when this person first came to call, is then victimized. See? Because they got another engram that says, blame, 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 not me, not me, not me. Boy, they certainly are summing their case all the time. They're saying, not me, not me, not me. There's not a me there. See this? You see how this could work then? All right. You must recognize this clearly if you're going to be a successful auditor all the way across the boards. You must recognize this person by his communication, by his ability to influence or not to influence the energy in his bank. Because sometimes people are so obliging that they seem to do everything possible for you. And they just don't get any better. What they've got is an obliging engram at work. See this? We had a girl whose name added up to, I won't tell you her exact name. Her name added up to, well, let's say her name added up to It's Wonderful. It did, almost. Her name added up to It's Wonderful. And every time the auditor, she'd say, it's wonderful. Her psychosomatic ills were not getting any better at all. You see this? She was dramatizing her name 100% of the time. Fantastic, hmm? All she'd do is just tell the auditor that how grand it was. And the individual, oddly enough, had a couple of fantastic things wrong with them anatomically. The body was really quitting, and yet the session did them so much good, and these characteristics never changed, session to session. And I finally tapped this auditor on the shoulder, and I said, look, I don't mean to be peeking through your head or anything like this, but I think that you would be better off if you found out if this person could at any time do anything about anything. Well, of course, this person could do anything about anything. He'd been running all kinds of terrific high echelon processes and so on. So So he remembered a lecture, and he said to the preacher, he said, being very sneaky, he said to the preacher, "Tell me a decision that you could make." And threw her into a 14-day comrade. You get this? When he told me this and told me he'd spent the rest of the session on just this one thing and she hadn't answered it yet, I then had him just kick it along for as many days as it would be necessary for her to finally come up with an answer. Her case began to mend when she first answered that question. What decision could she make? He was so intolerant of life that she couldn't even tolerate her own decisions. You see this? This was a rough beef. Power of choice. Power of choice, zero. If you cannot rehabilitate their power of choice, these people cannot be rehabilitated, regardless of what you do to them. This you've got to work on. And if this is true of the worst case there is, then this is certainly true of all the rest of the cases there are. An improvement of tolerance, an improvement of their power of choice. What are the difference between tolerances and power of choice? An individual who makes his power of choice because of relative intolerance is not making a power of choice. Got it? It's very, very simple. It's so simple that I can see a possibility of a tremendous calm lag on this in some guys. It's too simple, really. Stimulus response is a study of relative intolerances and choosing the least intolerance. Making a choice because of the least intolerance. That's it, see? Now, that's stimulus response. An individual goes out here, and he doesn't care, really, whether he eats steak or chops, but he sits there deciding on steak or chops, don't you see? And he sits there, and he sits there, trying to decide between steak or chops. And he finally finds out that chops have little white pants on them, you know? And he finds out that makes him less tolerant because they're more visible. So he orders steak. Get the idea? That's environmental decision based on intolerance. And that is stimulus response. And this stimulus response goes right on downhill and gets into energy and solid masses and everything else. Things don't become energy and solid masses because of intolerances. They become energy and solid masses because of terminals in the game called communication. But a person goes out of communication on his own determinism and into communication because of relative intolerances, simply to the degree that he has lost his ability to tolerate motion, no motion, and stupidity. He has to be able to tolerate those three things. Motion, no motion, stupidity. Those are the principal ones. There could be some others. But from these, you get tremendous ramifications. Oh, you can draw out the whole plot and pattern of life from these intolerances. A little bit below these, you find a whole new flock of them. There's a bunch more. There's intolerances for separateness and togethernesses. Just look at that on the second dynamic. Some preacher, I'm sure, sometime or another said to you, in so many words, "I just can't stand the idea of men and women standing together talking to each other. It just drives me mad." Well, don't consider this preacher as therefore nuts. You may have a preclear that couldn't stand it a long time ago. Get the idea? Couldn't stand it a long time ago, but since that time is so intolerant that he has abandoned the entire project. And he doesn't even know that men and women stand together. You see? Well, now you've got to understand when you process somebody, actually, the basis of ability. You've got to understand the basis of ability, because that's what you're trying to increase. You're not trying to polish up his engrams. You're not trying to move around his whirligigs. You're not trying to adjust the way he handles his fork. All you're trying to do is increase his tolerance and his power of choice. And to do this, you, to a marked extent, take over his power of choice and his intolerances, and then you let him have them back as fast as you are sure that he is the one who is getting them back. You got that? It's real simple. Now, we have him spotting objects. The optimum way to run a regimen of this character would be to select the object for the pre-clear and then get up to a point where you'd let him select the objects, you see? That'd be the optimum way to run it. As a matter of fact, power of choice usually doesn't enter in that low on the scale as level one. It would actually come in most markedly in the most regimented step of all, 8C. Opening procedure of 8C. Now you take over his total power of choice, except the choice to be there and have something done for him. And then restore it to him in three steps, A, B, and C. See? You'll restore it to him as fast as he's sure that it's his. You see this? All right. There's where we really handle it, and that's why 8C is still staying there. Now, whenever you have a designed regimen, the theory underlying this regimen is to restore to the individual first his first dynamic determinism, and then, as you go on, the remainder of his determinism, so we get into a condition of pan-determinism for the fellow as much as we possibly can, the willingness to assume all viewpoints. That is the theoretical height, the willingness to make any and all choices. Now, it would seem rather peculiar to you that if a cannonball were flying through the air, that you could change the course of the cannonball by thinking it was to go off at a divergence. Now, that would seem rather peculiar to you, right? Here's a cannonball. It's traveling at a vast rate of speed. It has tremendous mass. And it's traveling straight north. And you think at it, and it travels northwest. Would you please tell me the difference, the essential difference, between doing that and having a body, which, remember, wasn't yours in the first place, experience a sensation, or to turn a corner because you told it to? What's the difference? You're not a body part any more than you're part of the cannonball. Well, I'll tell you the main difference between them is that darn few people can change the course of a cannonball with a postulate. That's the main difference. But handle mass with a postulate. That is the ne plus ultra that you're working toward, power of choice. But that is not the highest thing there is. To handle thought with thought is higher than that. Fantastically true. That's way up in the stars. How would you do that? I used to have a little drill, kind of amusing. I had a conviction on this. When I was a kid, writing travel articles, so forth, so on, before I started writing very much fiction, and in the earliest days of fiction, I used to sit down and I would read the article on a pan basis. See, so the rest of the whole country would read the article. And I'd send it off and it would immediately be bought. And I sort of had this silly notion, you see, that if I did this carefully, I'd always sell the article. So I didn't do it one day and didn't sell the article, and that hung me with it, you see. To this day, I won't know completely how much this influenced it, because I've read some of those early articles, and although they had zip and so forth, I certainly can't figure out how anybody ever bought them. That's an interesting thing. That should be very interesting to you, this thing. All right, this person's body gets out of whack. Well, that's not by his choice. The body has made a choice to be out of whack. Now, the optimum would be for him to think, body okay, and it is. See? Now, we misinterpret that by saying he must be in a condition of orders. He must be able to orders. Orders is a low level of this. The truth of the matter is, he must search for and establish consents. You just think of the highest echelon of orders as establishing the highest echelon of consents. Then a person isn't following something like a cannonball. Here's thought handling thought. When a person cannot handle other people or cannot influence other people, let me assure you, he can't handle a cannonball either. And if he's got a broken leg, he can't say to it, broken leg, square around. Snap, bing, he's got a broken leg as well. He can't do that. This would surprise you. I know something that you would look at with incredulity, but there are people around who cannot heal broken legs or two heads with a postulate. Now, the reason you go on so many vias to get them to do it is because by these vias, they do find out they can do it. And the optimum course of processing would be to take less and less via toward the same goal. Make the postulate fix or unfix. That will have it influence or not influence it well. Now, somebody's around being very unhappy because when he thinks a thought, brother, does he get a somatic? He says he's very unhappy about this. He thinks one of these postulates or ideas that he reads in some old book on Dianetics or something, and wham, man, he's got somatics from jaw to crown and on the seat of his pants. He's in horrible condition. There's nothing wrong with this individual's power of choice, let me assure you. Not as far as humans are concerned. What is wrong with it is he doesn't know that it was he thinking it that did it, you see, to that degree. But he is able to influence and handle mass. Now he falls back and says he's got to drive a car with his hands on the steering wheel. He's got to do all kinds of vias. As a matter of fact, theoretically, all he is doing is directing the course of energy through spaces with a bunch of via postulates. You know? And we feel that if we get the postulate far enough removed and over enough vias, then some very interestingly effective things will occur. No, if we get the vias out between the postulate and the action, some very interesting things will occur. Man is going in the wrong direction, trying to put in more vias, unless he wants more game. If you want more game, put in more vias. If you want a faster game, start taking out vias, that's all. Via between the postulate and the action. Reaction time simply measures the number of vias between the postulate and the action. That's all it measures. Now, processing understood from this standpoint can make a lot more sense to you. If you understood this thoroughly, you could look over Preclear and tell exactly what he was doing and simply start getting him to know that he could reduce the number of vias in his action cycle considerably and make his postulates thereby more effective directly. When you have an individual who is very low scale, you get them to do something with thought that brings and exerts a better communication than they had. Now, the funny part of it is that control is the lower harmonic of communication. When an individual starts to go out of communication, he starts to get anxious about having terminals, therefore he feels he must control a terminal in order to have a communication terminal. And there's the only place control comes in, the only place where it's important. He wants this communication to take place via terminals. So he feels he must control the terminal in order to have it stand there and communicate. And his lack of control is liable to give him less communication. Well, just consider this as a bunch of vias, and you see where control comes from. Why should anybody get worried about control? Cannonball flies through the air, it's going 2,780 feet per second, and the fellow says, stop. It stops. He says, fall. It falls. But you don't have a game. Football is flying down the field, and it's going at 19 feet per second, or whatever footballs go at. Probably 88 feet per second. It's doing all right. Well, that's too high. Football probably goes about 27 feet per second. Anyhow, it's flying down the field, and one of the players in the opposite team says, stop, and it stops right there in midair. And he says, fall, and it falls. Nobody will sit in that stadium worth a nickel. And the reason they won't be fit to watch this game is because they can't tolerate this much postulate with that little communication connected with it. Communication, necessity for, reduces the effectiveness of the postulate. You have to reduce the effectiveness of the postulate in order to have communication. If you have communication, you will improve the effectiveness of the postulate. It's quite interesting. But one goes out of the postulate ability in order to get communication. And along with that, of course, he gets all parts of communication. He gets attention. After somebody had made a show out of it, the 27 feet per second football going down the field stops, falls. Somebody made a show out of this, circus act or something of the sort, done this a few times. The audience would say, that's fine, let's have another act, you know. He has violated parts of the communication formula by taking this much control and this few vias. Do you know that money is as good as it has vias? If you hide the source of money sufficiently, it has value. There is no other value to money than that. If you disclose its source exactly, such as they do in a central banking system, you get upset in the field of money. People don't consider it's valuable because they know who printed it. And they start talking about printing press money. What other kind is there? Well, you say there's money that really backs up property. Oh, is there? But if we put enough vias on it and hide it around enough corners, it becomes very valuable. And so then do people become valuable. So do footballs become valuable, and so forth. You see? Because they are derived at and controlled by a series of vias. The auditor is trying to find the optimum number of vias so the preclear can have a game. I can see that occasionally an auditor would run into somebody who had to have vias put in. He didn't have enough game. And an auditor would have to sit there and get this guy to actually add vias into his activity until he did have a game. The preclear doesn't have a game. Because the football is going down the field, he says, stop, it stops. He says, fall, it falls. It's just like this, just no more and no less than that. That's what's happening. And it's no game. He can't play football with anybody. An auditor might have to teach him to let the football fly all the way down the field and fall and bounce, doing it all the way, but not knowing that he was doing any of it. To do this, an auditor would have to rehabilitate, one, the number of vias which the individual wanted, and two, this oddity, this great oddity, he'd have to rehabilitate the postulate of not knowingness. He'd have to rehabilitate the preclear's ability to build machinery and hide it and so forth, and then the preclear could have all kinds of games with all kinds of vias on it and would probably be very happy about the whole thing. So we have ultimate power as one goal, ultimate effectiveness in fixing and unfixing postulates as one goal of all processing, starting at the beginning with no effectiveness in fixing or unfixing postulates on the part of the theta, and ending with total effectiveness of fixing and unfixing postulates at the other end. And monitoring this is the desire for a game with the pay communication. And a preclear will rise as fast and as high as he trusts that he can still improve himself and still have a game. He can improve himself up to the point of having a game. And above that point, he considers that he's going downhill, even though his postulates are getting more and more and more and more effective. What the preclear's idea of a game is may be something that the auditor has to straighten out too. And so we get the various factors with which we work in auditing. We have communication as the pay for a game, and the game itself monitoring a total recovery of the pre-clear at all times. And the auditor is seeking some balance between these points. And the factors he's dealing with are relatively simple factors. They are easy to handle. And when he handles processes without an understanding of these factors, they sometimes don't work. But if he understands them very thoroughly, then, of course, the processes work 17 times as fast. Thank you.